Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Castle Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. I want to talk about, you know, we talk about when things go wrong in the food world. I want to talk about when things go right in the food world. There's a new arrangement. Whole Foods, one of our favorite companies, Whole Foods has the southeast region of Whole Foods has struck an arrangement with a farmer. Farmer D has partners with Whole Foods in a closed loop, cradle to cradle relationship that goes like this, cradle to cradle. You'll see what I mean in a second. Whole Foods from the southeast region will truck all of its old fruits and veggies to the Longwood Centennial Farm, a Georgia Centennial Farm located near Savannah. That's near where Farmer D runs the Hampton Island Preserve Biodynamic Farm. Farmer D takes all this green waste, adds some composted cotton gin waste, some pine needles, some peanut byproducts, some peat hummus, some granite dust, a couple of biodynamic tinctures that he makes with flowers and stinging nettles and oak bark in them. And he then composts it without turning it. So he makes this, throws it all together, lets it compost, becomes a very, very rich compost. And now you're ready for this? He sells it to farmers who supply Whole Foods with the original produce.
That sounds like a perfect little circle.
It's great.
It's a circle of life.
It is. It is indeed a circle of life.
It is. I know it is.
So I think that's wonderful. He'll also be selling it to consumers at every southeastern Whole Foods. That includes every store in Georgia, North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Alabama, starting around April 1st. It's called Farmer D Organics Biodynamic Blend Organic Compost. And if you're in, if you're listening to us in one of those states, in Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, or Alabama, look for Farmer D Organics at Whole Foods, and that's a great thing that they're doing.
We haven't talked about composting very much, and you know, a few of our listeners out there do it, and I'm not even sure, Francis, you know that the farm that I've talked about in upstate New York that my father ran for about 10, 12 years, just a family farm, just for to feed us. He was a composter way back in the early 80s. We composted everything. I mean, everything biodegradable went into the compost pile, from chicken eggs to, you name it, grass clippings, everything that was compostable.
I think that's actually a
word. I'm going to go with compostable, and I'm sticking with it.
I think you just made it up, but someone made it up before you.
And it was, you know, you talk about it being very, very rich material. It is extremely rich material, and everything grows in a rich compost like that. It's the best fertilizer you can possibly put out on your crops, in your fields, in your on the things that you're trying to grow. Things grew amazingly on the basic little rock quarry of a garden we had.
You know, what's particularly interesting about this arrangement with Whole Foods, it's really fortuitous, and it's really mutual beneficial, and it brings the compost back to the farm where it originated, which, you know, I remember that Craig Shelton had the Ryland Inn in New Jersey here. It was a wonderful restaurant, and he had a kitchen garden. He was one of the first guys in New Jersey, if not the first guy in New Jersey, to really have a kitchen garden that I know of. And it was wonderful. I loved to go there, especially in August and September. And he had a full-time gardener, and he had a couple acres. And what he would do was he tried to make it as complete a circle as possible. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for this. And he said, you know, the only thing that keeps us from being absolutely renewable is that the consumers take the waste home with them. And he said, other than that, you know, I've got to bring in a little bit of fertilizer, and I do compost my waste and stuff, but... And Craig was doing that in 99?
What I'm going to say is, if you have the space for it, It's much easier than you think it is.
And you can go online if you're interested. And look, I live in Jersey City and I haven't done it because I'm just not that interested. I also don't eat at home very often, so I don't have a lot of compostable garbage at home. But there are urban composting. Go to Google urban compost, and you'll find ways to compost things at home in a way that doesn't smell. I mean, people think,
I'm just telling you, the compost pile didn't smell.
But
it wasn't, you know, it wasn't perfume, but it didn't smell like manure. It didn't smell like what most people think of when they think of compost.
Well, and the thing is, though, you've got to manage it. You know, you can't just throw all your garbage in a pile in the backyard. That's not composting.
Right. You're separate. You have to separate those biodegradable things out.
Well, and again, even all the biodegradable things, you can't just throw them in a pile. You've got to throw them in with some lime. You've got to throw them in, make sure you have the right balance in there. It's not that difficult. You just need to know what you're doing, or you will get a pile of festering garbage full of vermin, which you would probably want to avoid, especially if you're living in an urban area, but even out in the country. But the compost is, you know, it's good for the environment, but it is great tomatoes, great. And I'm probably moving out of Jersey City soon, and I'm looking, you know, I'm into the house, yard, porch, dog part of my life,
Life's a-changing.
Yeah, but I wonder if I'll actually ever act upon my intentions to grow a garden, because it sounds so nice as an idea, but
I will tell you that I started one in Cranford, which is not too far from the radio station here for those of you not listening in the New Jersey area. I started one in Cranford, and there are rabbits and squirrels that basically ate everything I planted, and I said, okay, I can either build a rabbit-proof fence. But the squirrels can get through that, and the squirrels were eating my tomatoes, which boggled my mind. Or I can stop trying to do this and let somebody else battle them and go to the farmer's market and buy what I need. Mm. And that's the direction I went.
You know, our friend Mike, who's an attorney, is his first career, but he has several acres that he's protecting from development in East Brunswick, and he plants some stuff. After conferring with us, he plants some stuff
for us
that we use through the course of the year. And what's interesting is he has a farm and he's got a gun. And if you're zoned as a farm and you're a working farm, you know how you deal with squirrels? You shoot them.
Stop them from eating your stuff.
Yeah, they ground hunt. You trap them, or you can kill anything on your own property. You don't need a hunting license. You don't need any of that. You're just on the farm. And I think, you know, that's the reality of a farm.
It's a little bit of the strong survive.
It's actually kind of cool to go out there and help them do that, too.
Top of the food chain.
I kind of like that. All right, well, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:14. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Frederick Kaufman is a professor at the City University of New York. He's written about American food culture and other subjects for Harper's Magazine, The New Yorker, Gourmet, Gastronomica, and The New York Times Magazine. He's here with us today to discuss his new book, A Short History of the American Stomach.
Frederick, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
So, the stomach, huh?
That's right.
So, talk to us about your book, A Short History of the American Stomach. Why look at America through the stomach? Because it's really not about the stomach, it's about America.
Well, you know, I was really interested, as I was looking around the American landscape, at how obsessed people seem to me with what they would and would not eat. All these crazy diets, all the foodies, and all the chow hounds, and then plus, on a larger level, we have this hysteria about the obesity epidemic, we have the endless articles about anorexia, and then, of course, we have food issues of the New Yorker, of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, these kind of endless obsessions with renovating our kitchens and going on food vacations. And I said to myself, what is going on here? How did this happen? And I thought I would trace it back as far as I could, all the way to the very beginning of American culture, and see how we got to this present state of food obsession.
Now, let's talk about that premise right there. Is it your opinion that we are more obsessed with food in the ways that you've outlined than any other culture?
Well, you know, I don't think anybody would argue that the Chinese are obsessed with food, or that the French are obsessed with food, or that the Italians are obsessed with food. We are obsessed with food in a very different way than they are, in the sense that I think that in other cultures, in Asian cultures, in European cultures, food has its proper place. It might be a very central place, an extraordinarily important place, but it stays in its place. Here in America, in this country, it's as though food were a river that's constantly overflowing its shores. In other words, we don't know where it begins, where it ends, and it bleeds into every aspect of our waking and sleeping lives.
Well, one of the ways that we've embraced food in this country is by overabundance. The way that we handle food differently than those other places that you've mentioned is big is more.
Look, a lot of people came here because they were hungry, and the fact of the matter is that when they got here, it's true for a while they had some trouble feeding themselves, but they got the hang of it pretty quickly. And New York markets, for instance, and East Coast markets, were the most amazingly full markets in the world. Nothing in Europe could compare to the markets on the East Coast 300 years ago. In fact, I was looking into the statistics of, you know, what was for sale in particular markets on the East Coast. In New York City, for instance, in the beginning of the 19th century, in like 1810 or so, you could buy 18 different kinds of duck just in New York City. In terms of fish, you could buy porpoise, you could buy snook, you could buy dolphin, you could buy whale, you could buy skunk, you could buy badger.
And this didn't happen in Europe.
No, there is nothing like this in Europe. Look, as late as you know, the end of the 19th century, you could still see for sale in Ohio markets and Iowa markets panther steaks and bear steaks.
Wild. You know, one of the things that you made allusion to in your opening comments about our relationship with food is it comes unmoored and it's not in its place in the way that ethnic European cuisines are in their place. And one of the things that always jumps out at me is that we are the fattest country in the world, and we are the country that sells more diet products than any country in the world, be it books or supplements or meals or frozen meals. What do you think that's? Where does that come from? Is it because we've come unmoored from our ancestral cultures that bounded cuisine in the past?
Well, I was astounded by that fact, and I looked back, and what I was even more astounded about was that this was the same kind of complaint about our culture we see 100 years ago and even 200 years ago. We see diet books railing against American obesity and eating too much sugar and eating too much meat 100 years ago and 200 years ago and even before. This is not a new problem in our culture, and that really amazed me. And I was thinking, why is this? Why have Americans always been unable to figure out, let's say, portion control, right? And I think a lot of it has to do with this sense of the continent being so large and that push towards what's called in history classes manifest destiny.
Manifest
in my book,
destiny.
I call it manifest dinner. The idea that we can devour and annihilate that landscape going west all the way to California, the idea that no matter how great your appetite might be, you can satiate it. Otherwise known as the American dream.
You talk, though, about right from the Puritans, they had sort of an odd relationship with food as well, with both feast and famine.
Yeah, the Puritan case was also quite interesting to me. One of the things that's hard to get your head around or your stomach around is that, you know, the stomach has its own place. We were talking in the very first conversation today. In our bodies today. It has to share the limelight with the heart and the liver and the brain and other bodily organs. You have to realize that 300, 400 years ago, when the Puritans got here, the stomach was much more central. It was the central part of the anatomy, central part of the physiology, and central in terms of their psychology. In other words, mood was all about your stomach. And not only that, the stomach was the center of a relationship with God. In other words, it had a lot to do with their theology. If you had a bad stomach, that meant you were in a bad way with God. And in fact, if you had a very bad stomach, the dread dyspepsia, that meant that Satan might actually be inside you. And of course, there were many ways to get him out.
None of them pleasant, I'm sure.
I have seen. We don't have to go here, but I have seen the lists of the medical procedures.
Oh my goodness! To get Satan out of you?
Well, leeches is one of those ways, and
but that wasn't a Satan thing, was it? Leeches?
Look, I think the idea leeches. Well, look. The bottom line is that the Puritans really were the founders of our bulimia rectic culture. In a sense, they were very into fasting to perfect themselves, and they were also very into puking.
That's awesome. So I never did like those Puritans. We'll come back in just a moment and talk more with Frederick Kaufman about his book, A Short History of the American Stomach. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. We're talking with Frederick Kaufman about his book, A Short History of the American Stomach. You can find out more about it on our website, RestaurantGuysRadio.com. We'll put a link up there. We were talking about the Puritans at the very beginning of the American stomach, and they would purge, you said. You know, there's a history of that in America. But they had a strange relationship with food overall, didn't they? I mean, and back to the Salem witch trials, you make a connection with food in the Salem witch trials.
Yeah, I think that the Puritans really discovered that they could use food as a form of social control in this country. In other words, by insisting that people feast on certain days and that they fast on other days, they could really make them do what they wanted them to do. I think that we can see this today with the increasing legislation about eating habits in this country. You know, you can eat this, you can't eat that. This, you know, it is illegal to eat, you know, too much food if you're obese. You know, all these strange laws that are being bandied about. The Puritans were the masters of this kind of law. And it is true. And when the witch hysteria hit Salem, a lot of the people very involved in the trial were doing a lot of fasting. And this tended to increase their nervous excitement about what was going around them, what was going on around them. And, of course, part of the big prosecution of these witches was, when they walked by my house, my butter went bad. They curdled my milk. I mean, what could be a worse crime?
Oh, my God. So those were the crimes they were charged with?
And not only that, in order, when they first tried to ascertain who was a witch and who had made them, you know, who had demonized them, who had possessed them, they actually baked what they called a witch cake, if you can believe it, a very strange kind of cake. They used the urine of one of the possessed children and used it to cook a rye cake and then fed it to a dog in the hopes that that dog, after eating the cake, would lead them to the person who was guilty. Can you imagine this?
Yeah, well, what it led them was to the pet lover in the town. That's the problem.
Yeah, they got in trouble with the ASPCA.
Oh,
yeah.
No, I mean, well, the dog went to, so the next person the dog went to, they assumed was a witch. Those Puritans weren't so smart. How'd they ever get across the Atlantic Ocean?
I'll tell you, but they got across by fasting.
When we come back, we're going to talk more with Frederick Kaufman about his book, and we'll bring us a little more contemporary with the short history of the American stomach. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through RestaurantGuysRadio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Frederick Kaufman about his wonderful book, A Short History of the American Stomach. If you'd like to pick up the book yourself or learn more about it, you can go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and we'll have a link up there by the end of the day. Frederick, in talking with about the history of the American stomach, we were talking about the Puritans and their control over food and how societal control in many societies comes down to control over food. In our own country, we have crazy laws out there, as you alluded to as well. One of the things that is forbidden in our country, in most states, and is almost forbidden in the states where it's not forbidden, is the sale of raw milk, which is unpasteurized milk from a cow. Now, raw milk was consumed. I mean, it's one of the seminal foods. It's one of the two foods
milk
mentioned in the Bible. It's one of the two things created as food. Milk and honey are the only things that are really created with the purpose of being food. Yet that's illegal in the United States. You wrote about that somewhat in your book as well. Can you talk to us about the illegality of raw milk and the movement to legalize it again?
Yeah, well, milk has long been one of the most highly regulated substances in America. Even going back to colonial days, milk could only be sold by certain vendors in certain times and certain places. And there's also a long-standing fear of milk being tainted with chalk or other chemicals, and therefore it became part of a vast legislative group of laws. And of course, one of the big laws these days is it should be pasteurized, because of course, unpasteurized milk, it is possible that this can carry listeria or brucellosis or tuberculin bacteria.
But we can test for those things now.
Yeah, we can. And in fact, the fact of the matter is that in California and in Oregon, you can have raw milk. There are particular places where you can buy raw
Pennsylvania's
milk. But not in New York,
Pennsylvania's
not in
New
got Jersey.
A few as well.
I infiltrated a raw milk coven in New York City, and this was one of the craziest things I ever did. I was there when the driver came up with the Amish delivery man of the raw milk, and everybody was very paranoid. It was kind of a cold and dark night in New York City, and we were all concerned that at any moment the door would be bashed down, you know, New York State milk control up against the wall. And these guys, the raw milk people, are huge believers in the incredible capacity of milk to cure. Now, going back hundreds of years, milk has been seen as a cure. But these guys believe that milk is going to cure them of their eczema, of their heart disease, of their ADD, of their depression, of this host of diseases that can be cured by raw milk or raw yogurt or whey or cheese that hasn't been aged 90 days. The funniest thing is that I thought there'd be a lot of camaraderie and, you know, everybody would be very happy to see each other. But in fact, these guys are a very paranoid bunch, very much like the Puritans. And what they're most afraid of is that some almond-crunching tattooed vegan is going to infiltrate their ranks and blow them with New York State Milk Authority, because they have yet to make a truce with the soy milk drinkers. They're at war, the raw milk drinkers versus the soy milk drinkers.
Oh, my Lord. So what are the soy milk drink now? The vegans say, vegetarians say, we shouldn't raise animals and kill them for food. Vegans say that you can't exploit your cow by taking its milk. That milk was meant for the baby calves.
That's right.
And also, if you have a pet, you're being disrespectful to your pet. It's actually an animal companion.
That's right. In fact, you should be your pet's pet, probably.
And you're a wackadoo if you believe that.
I want to talk about something, though. But
never milk your dog.
That you mentioned.
Never do that. I'm against that.
I want to talk about something that you mentioned in the book when you talk about milk, though. And one of the reasons that the raw milk people are concerned about getting caught. And that's because there's a very large lobby on the side of the large milk companies. I mean, you mention in your book that there are four companies that control 85% of the milk sales in the country.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. And in fact, when I first started publishing about this, I was widely reviled across the internet as a stooge of big dairy. You know, that I was somehow, you know, defending them. And in fact, the truth of the matter is that a lot of the pasteurization is used. To shield big dairy from some practices which might not be, you know, the most sanitary. If you do pasteurize, it's a forgiving process, so your milk doesn't have to be 100%, you know, perfect. They're also very concerned about the enzymes, they meaning the raw milkers.
Mm-hmm.
They're very concerned about the enzymes in the milk being obliterated by the heating techniques of pasteurization.
Well, I think, you know, it comes down, we're advocates of making raw milk legal and regulated, but it comes down to, you know, control. And who controls the food is a very important it's a very important social control. And they say that something like 70% of the brands in your supermarket are owned by six parent companies. So you think there's a lot of diversity in your market, and there's a lot of diversity, but there's not really a lot of diversity of who owns that stuff.
Well, not only that, people, you know, markets are very, they're places that people don't really understand. You look at the fresh produce section, for instance, you think maybe here we're getting back to nature when we're looking at our oranges and pears and bananas. What I learned through my research into modern-day supermarkets is that almost everything you see, every piece of produce, the fresh produce, they're all patented. Everything that you're looking at is somebody else's intellectual property, and somebody's earning a royalty every time you buy that tangerine or that plum.
Isn't that crazy?
Or that papaya.
We've changed a fundamental way of living on this planet, and that people can own life and own the DNA of something, so that, you know, you can't. So it would be illegal when one of those things is patented for you to take it home, take the seeds out and plant it in your backyard. If you did that, you'd be infringing upon their patent and have to pay those companies.
Certainly if you did it commercially. I spent a lot of time with a fellow who was actually very involved in making a better oyster. He actually has a patent on making oysters in the laboratory, a certain kind of oyster. And, you know, this is classic of American historical phenomena, which is that here we are, we're so completely hungry that we eat all of the oysters in the Chesapeake Bay, all the oysters in New York Harbor, all the oysters in the Raritan Bay, you know, they're all gone. So what are we going to do? Let's make a new one. And that's what this guy does. He makes oysters down in Virginia. And then now you can go to the Grand Central Oyster Bar in New York City, and I can tell you which ones were chromosome whacked by a laboratory in southern New Jersey.
Unbelievable.
And that's then remember, it's issues of control. Then that's owned by somebody in perpetuity.
And to be fair, Frederick, we didn't just eat all of them. We killed a lot of them, too.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And also they died. You know, oysters are very susceptible to viruses.
Mm. Yeah. And now let's talk about a happier character in your book, but one who really changed. He went from a glutton to a patriot. You discuss, of course, Yankee Doodle the Dandy.
Oh, Yankee Doodle Dandy himself.
Yes. Talk to us about Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah, well, the original Yankee Doodle Dandy, I was wondering where this song came from, and I found that originally it's a song about shucking and eating corn, and that it's about the great corn festivals when everybody would just be a real glutton and eat too much and get really drunk and fall over. And those were the original verses that I found of Yankee Doodle. It also reminds me, of course, when we talk about Yankee Doodle and Americana on this level, I'm always reminded of America's founding foodie, who would, of course, have to be Ben Franklin, who was completely obsessed by his eating choices and even went so far as to say the only way he, Ben Franklin, was ever able to learn mathematics was by being on a vegetarian diet.
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe that's why I never learned it.
There you go.
Well, when we come back, I want to take the conversation in the direction of a topic that, you know, any discussion of American cuisine would be incomplete without getting to. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about, with Frederick Kaufman and his book, A Short History of the American Stomach, we're going to talk about cannibalism in the United States, which, you know, of course we have to talk about that. Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1144. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Frederick Kaufman about his book, A Short History of the American Stomach. I really hadn't, it caught me by surprise, to be honest with you, Frederick. to find the cannibalism playing such a large role in this.
Frederick, I have to apologize. Basically, any book or any person who ever mentions cannibalism in their book or in any of their writings, Francis has to talk about it.
It is the elephant in the room. It is the elephant in the room. So talk to us about cannibalism in America.
Well, I think that one of the things that people forget about cannibalism was this kind of European nightmare, you know, this idea that there could be people out there in the world who are actually eating other people. And, of course, Columbus discovered this in America. He discovered cannibalism was actually happening in this country when he got here and he saw what was happening in Mexico. And ever since in this country, cannibalism has held a real corner of our collective imagination, as we can see by this conversation. And in fact, as American history progressed, cannibalism progressed along with it. What do I mean by that? Well, for instance, no less a person than Davy Crockett used to brag about his cannibalism. In fact, the more involved in politics he became, he used to say stuff like, "I will eat any man opposed to Jackson." And as the frontiersmen moved west, the whole notion of, you know, of course this happened in the Donner Party, but the whole idea of, I am going to be a famous, great, bad, nasty frontiersman, I'm going to drink your blood, I'm going to eat you if you cross my path, this made for the American mythology.
Well, now, I know of a couple of instances, and they're certainly well-publicized, like the Donner Party being the most famous, and for any of our listeners who don't remember what the Donner Party what happened to the Donner Party is they were headed out west. They were running behind. They took a shortcut through the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Utah. They were stopped in their tracks by an early snowstorm.
Winter.
And they were basically stopped in their tracks for the winter. They sent some folks out for rescue, but most of the people stayed behind at base camp. They ran out of food. Half of the people died, and the half that didn't die stayed alive by eating the meat of those who had died.
This cannibalism, like the Donner Party, was a staple of the tabloid journalism of the 19th century. In other words, there are always the whaling ships that would get overturned and people would end up in the lifeboats having to resort to cannibalism in order to survive. And of course, there's the famous case of the most famous celebrity cannibal. His name is Alfred Packer, who was a miner who actually ended up murdering the people who had found some gold with him in the famous Slumgullion Pass and actually ate them all for lunch, too.
Now, was this are instances of cannibalism in a uniquely New World phenomenon? I mean, you said it was this dark fantasy of Europe, but I don't remember reading about anyone getting stuck in the Alps and having to eat their buddy.
You know, it's not only America, it's a New World phenomena. In other words, cannibalism is kind of drummed out of Europe, you know, of course, for, you know, some very bizarre cases, which are not at all of the ordinary. But in the New World and in the islands, you know, as the age of exploration begins, they begin to see this phenomena actually occurring. And, of course, it's occurring in a very large scale in Mexico.
Now, but do you think it's that if Europeans were, you know, trapped in the Alps for I guess, in Europe, where do you get trapped for the winter?
Don't you remember that book, Alive?
Yeah, and the movie. That was a big thing. The soccer team.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was mesmerized by this.
Mm-hmm. My buddy Kevin Bresnahan, who was a waiter with me when I was a bartender, my first job, had a role in that movie. He was the guy who lost it and said, "I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore." And somebody else slaps him. That was it. That was his big role. It was great. No, he was very believable. I couldn't take it anymore. Let's talk briefly about, in your history of the American stomach, you talk about cloned fruits and vegetables in today's market, and discuss your views on those with us.
You know, cloned fruits and vegetables are all over. I mean, the banana, the genetic variability for the regular dessert banana is down to so few variables that a lot of the banana people are saying that it's one virus away from extinction. And almost all of our fruits and vegetables, particularly our apples, what could be more American than an apple, these are all cloned. The fact of the matter is that so many people are upset about cloning beef and cloning meat. This is one of the more unpopular positions that I finally ended up having to take, by dint of just talking to all these scientists out there. I mean, a lot of people might feel uncomfortable with a fish gene in their banana, let's say. But if you really are to understand DNA, you will see that there's a big salad of DNA inside everyone and everything. We have plant DNA inside of us. We share about a third of our DNA with an oyster, for crying out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sense is that with the growing scarcity of food supply, if you look at the prices of commodities, how corn prices have tripled, wheat is going up, you know, we are seeing increasing competition from the rest of the world, and it is conceivable in the future we are going to see some increasing scarcity. The only way that we're going to eventually compete in global marketplaces is through high tech. And I think it's actually sad that there is such a popular wave of knee-jerk reaction against it. We're losing market share to the Chinese. We're planting acres and acres of apple orchards. Now, we can't compete with them on labor costs. They're paying their workers $1 a day to harvest apples. Now, we can't do that, nor should we. However, we can work with high tech to increase our yield.
You know, I have to say, and I hate to have the last word on this and end the show, but we're of a different opinion. I think that we can. I'm not a free trader. I don't mind keeping market share with tariffs. But I think that when we lose genetic diversity in the crops that we have in the field and in the world, it's a tremendous risk, and it concentrates the ownership of that stuff in a way that's unacceptable.
And can I just say one thing, which
sure.
is that actually most of this is happening to increase the diversity. That's the interesting idea about it.
But when the different pieces of the puzzle are owned by major corporations and you can't take the seed of an apple and plant your own apple tree, we've fundamentally changed who controls what we eat, which is fundamentally controlling our lives.
And the diversity.
But, you know, there's room for a great opinion. I think that we would like to invite you back to do an entire other show of a debate on the one point with which we disagree with you.
Absolutely. I would love to do that. It's great talking to you.
That sounds fun. Hey, the book is terrific. Frederick, thanks for coming on our show.
Thank you.
It's called A Short History of the American Stomach. You can find out more about it on our website at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We were talking over the break about, it's funny, we agree with Frederick on everything except for cloning.
Well, I want to get Frederick back on the show because I really do want him to flesh out his opinions on this, because one of the things he talks about is that we're so close to having bananas be extinct. And one of the reasons we're so close to bananas being extinct is because we have basically pared down the number of types of bananas that there are in the world. So there are only a couple of different types of bananas in the world right now, and if something happens to that to affect those bananas, no more bananas. We're
yeah.
done.
Well, and that's for example, when you had in America, you had the American walnut tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sister's house is basically built of walnut. It's up in Mountain Lakes, and it's a beautiful old house called a Hapgood. And it's walnut all over the inside of the house, mm-hmm. walnut structurally important to the house. Well, those are built from American walnut trees. There are no American – the reason it was because they were abundant and cheap, because you just chopped them down from the lot and built your house with what you chopped down. They're not there anymore because the American walnut trees were attacked by a virus that came over from Europe to which they were susceptible and had no defenses. And they were gone in a matter of a few years. The American walnuts, just when that crop of trees died off, and they died off quickly, they were unable to repropagate. We now have walnut because there are other varieties
of walnut trees.
In the world. There are European walnuts, and those survive. If all of the walnut trees in the world had been of that one particular...
Have the same genetic DNA... When the virus comes, you know, if all your pigs have the same genetic DNA, if all your bananas have the same genetic DNA, when the thing comes that affects them adversely, it goes through it very quickly and you're done.
Mm. Yeah.
And that's why we need the diversity. We must have the diversity. You know, Frederick's opinion was that cloning will create diversity. I'm not sure that I buy it.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, we don't know Frederick's opinion, but we're going to have him back on the show and we're going to find it out.
Great.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I think it's important that people who care about good food and people who care about doing the right thing realize that people of goodwill can have different opinions, and we do. And so we'll flesh them out next time. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.